From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington. And here are the issues. The United States suspended cooperation with Russia over Syria after Russia and the Assad regime continued to bomb the besieged city of Aleppo. In their one and only debate, the two American vice presidential candidates agreed on a more muscular U.S. policy for Syria, but clashed over immigration, abortion, and the comments of Republican candidate Donald Trump. The United Nations Security Council approved a new U.N. Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, a former Portuguese prime minister. His current job is dealing with the massive exodus of refugees around the world, especially from Syria and other countries in the Middle East and North Africa. And the Obama administration harshly criticized Israel for approving expansion of a settlement so deep in the West Bank that it all but precludes creation of a contiguous Palestinian state. Oren, we're going to start with the Syria situation. The State Department announced that the United States has suspended contacts with Russia over Syria, and then the next day, Secretary of State John Kerry called Sergei Lavrov again. So have we suspended talks with him? Have we suspended cooperation? And is there any hope to relieve the siege of eastern Aleppo?
Ever since the ceasefire collapsed on the 19th, there's been this ongoing bombardment of Aleppo, and civilians have been dying there. Something like 1,400, I think, civilians have died, have been injured or killed in Aleppo since the ceasefire ended. The State Department had been asking the Russians to stop this aerial campaign to control the Syrians, and they haven't. So they did the suspension, and they said that they're suspending bilateral engagement on Syria. Now, bilateral engagement usually means one-on-one engagement. Mm-hmm. But then they said, but they're not suspending the deconfliction of the military to keep the planes from shooting each other down. And then it turned out the next day that they're also not suspending one-on-one talks between Kerry and Lavrov about Syria.
Right.
So there's been a lot of discussion at the press briefings about what exactly was suspended. And my best understanding of what the State Department is saying is that what they're suspending is talks. I guess they have teams that talk about peace talks and teams that talk about the ceasefire, mm-hmm. and that's what they're suspending.
And potential joint targeting of Nusra Front and ISIS.
They also had this joint implementation center, they called it, that they were going to set up and they were working on preparing for it to set up after mm-hmm. if the ceasefire lasted for 7 days, and that was suspended also.
Yeah. Michael, the relationship between the United States and Russia is as bad as I can remember it in 25 years or longer. The Russians now say that they brought in anti-aircraft missile batteries to protect Syrian airfields. There is talk that the United States might do something military. But of course, we know President Obama has been reluctant to get more deeply involved in the conflict. What's your sense of what the options are at this point to try to at least relieve the humanitarian crisis in Aleppo?
There are a few, but what's in doubt is the effectiveness of them, especially since you can't get anyone to agree that even internally what those methods would be. And you have to have some compliance, some cooperation with the Russians, and you have none currently. You do have a lot of saber rattling that's going on that really portends some sort of proxy war that could be imminent. You talk about the Russians saying, we have troops embedded all over Syria, so an attack on a Syrian position, if there's Soviet or Russian loss of life, there would be, right, there would be, dating back to them, that would be considered an attack on Russia. Mm. It's a very, very tenuous situation here, and I think that President Obama's hands are tied in terms of this military solution that's being pushed forward by the Pentagon. They're calling for targeted airstrikes on certain or Syrian army positions or Air Force bases, that sort
fields,
of thing.
Airfields, maybe.
And you have the Russians saying, well, we have anti-aircraft positions set up there, and the United States should, quote-unquote, consider the consequences of something like this.
Yeah.
And that rightfully so. They really should consider the consequences. Look, I think that sanctions out the window clearly don't exist. In the middle of a transition of power, the peaceful transition of power in the United States, I'm sure that the Obama administration doesn't want to get too deeply committed to a military solution and hand over something to the next president that is even more complicated than it is right now. So the options really, there's very few of them, and it appears that none of them really are good.
I would say that there are options that are between going to outright war, things that we did in Afghanistan we could mm-hmm. do here. We could be giving assistance to the moderate rebels that have been asking for assistance.
So-called moderate.
Ever, you know, since this began. There's fewer and fewer of them left. A lot of them have been killed. But, you know, initially there were more of them, and now there's questions as to whether they're completely tied up and married to al-Qaeda or if they're just, if it's a marriage of convenience or if it's a marriage of the heart, right?
Mm, yeah.
There are options. How
about humanitarian, you know, airdrops of food and medicine, that sort of thing?
You know, in an urban environment, I think that's a little tricky. But we're talking about the United States of America. It is the most powerful country with the biggest economy in the world still, and it has options. There are things that it can do. If it's willing to accept some of the consequences. And yeah. That's what I think is the issue.
You talked about the moderate rebels. One of the issues and one of the Russian objections was that the United States was supposed to somehow sort out these groups and force the more moderate groups to divorce themselves from the Nusra Front, which has given itself a new name, but it's still the al-Qaeda affiliate. And mm-hmm. The Russians complained that the United States was not able to do that. What are the prospects for that?
Well, I think the Russians happen to be right on this one, that the United States has not been able to do that. I've been at the briefings and asked the State Department, you know, State Department spokesman about this, and he said, well, if they're not attacking, if they're observing the ceasefire, then it doesn't really apply to them, which isn't exactly what the ceasefire agreement says. It says that they can be attacked, that they're fair game, the Nusra Front. So I think this issue is sort of the poison pill in this ceasefire agreement, is that the Americans are working with the what they call the legitimate opposition, which is working with al-Qaeda, which everybody agrees is a terrorist organization and fair game. So anybody who's working mixed with in with al-Qaeda ends up becoming a fair target.
Yeah.
And the Russians and Syrians treat everybody who's fighting against the Syrian regime as terrorists and mixed in with al-Qaeda. So that means that basically the entire opposition is a fair target to them.
Michael, what are the chances that Aleppo will fall before a new president takes office in the United States? And is the Obama administration, I don't know how to put this entirely, I mean, they say that they don't want Aleppo to fall, but at the same time, you have this tremendous fear of what the alternative to Assad would be. And do you think that there are some in the U.S. who actually would like that to happen and for Assad to consolidate his control of what's called useful Syria?
I have heard that very discussion, that maybe you have too, with people in sort of like parlor discussion about what happens if Assad does stay.
Yeah.
And it's sort of been the red line position of the United States that Assad must go under any solution. But really, if you have the United States looking for peace right now, in terms of what we're trying to do diplomatically, it seems to me we're looking for peace. And what Russia more and more seems to be looking for is victory. And if you have those two parties looking for different things, at some point you have to get up to a position where the Russians are also looking for peace. And that doesn't seem to be in their interest right now.
But it might be after Aleppo falls.
It might be
if
Aleppo falls. And that's where the parlor discussion goes. If we let them get that, see that as a small victory, and then work peace backwards from that event. But also you run the risk of an emboldened Putin going for more.
Yeah.
Coming back to the negotiating table, rather going forward.
Yeah. And of course, another humanitarian catastrophe on the order of Srebrenica
exactly.
and Rwanda and all the rest.
I wouldn't call that a small victory.
Yeah,
Aleppo.
It would be a rather huge
victory.
Syria's rather
largest,
huge
largest city.
Exactly.
Oren, the issue of Syria actually popped up in the vice presidential debate that was held a few days ago. And it was interesting, actually. There was remarkable agreement between Tim Kaine and Mike Pence about creating some kind of safe zone. And Mike Pence also had some very harsh things to say about Vladimir Putin. And I wondered at one point exactly whose running mate he was.
Well, you know, it was a very interesting debate, especially when it comes to foreign policy, because Mike Pence did something that I've seen a lot of conservative supporters of Donald Trump do, which is to invent a foreign policy for him. That is, you know, that's at least something that Donald Trump has never expressed. Yeah, Mike Pence said that there should be safe zones, and he and Tim Kaine agreed on that. But we've never heard the Donald say anything about that, as far as I know.
No, as far as I know, he's praised Vladimir Putin. and has even in the past said nice things about Bashar al-Assad.
Right. So he has spoken multiple times in favor of what he calls strong leaders, mm-hmm. Including Assad and Putin and
Saddam Hussein
yes. and Kim Jong-un even.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Donald Trump's Mount Rushmore of foreign leaders, as right. I think Tim Kaine put it.
Right. So I'm not sure if we want to switch to the debate now, but there were all these issues that yeah. Mike Pence basically put out his own platform.
Yeah,
I saw the debate as Mike Pence running, and some other people said this, you know, they looked like he was running for president for
2020.
Yeah. You know, he talked about trade. He was very much in favor of trade. And we know that Donald Trump wants to raise tariffs on U.S. trading partners. So I wasn't really sure what to make of all that.
Yeah. Michael, what did you make of the debate? And I don't know, is it fair to ask who won in a situation like that?
It is fair to ask who won. I think you have to divide that question into two categories. I think, you know, factually, from a fact-based perspective, Tim Kaine won because, as you say, Mike Pence is just trying his best to duck and dodge. You know, the comments that have come from the Trump campaign to now, and also the lack of policy that's come over, the lack of substantial information that comes from that campaign. And he's literally trying to make it up on the fly or give his own opinion of that thing. So I think from a factual, from a contextual, from a policy standpoint, I did think that Tim Kaine won the day. However, from a style standpoint, you could very much see that Mike Pence has experience in front of a microphone and in front of a camera. And he used that very much to his advantage, especially when it comes to the category of what I call the silent movie. Now that they're doing these campaigns in a split screen,
sure.
when the other guy is talking, you're basically on a silent movie there, and your facial expressions, the way you nod, what you do when you're not speaking almost counts as much in the perception of what you're doing in that debate as what you do when you're saying.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor, and joining me today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and Oren Durrell of USA Today. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Oren, let's get back to the style versus the substance. I thought that Pence mastered what I call the bemused grimace when Kaine would be rattling off all these horrific things that Trump had said about Mexicans and immigrants in general and Muslims and so on. And you could just see, you know, Pence kind of smile with a little bit of a grimace in it because he knew very well that these allegations were absolutely true.
You know, I tend to listen to these things more for the substance and the facts, but it was clear that watching it, you know, Tim Kaine came across as somewhat overeager and a little bit like an attack dog, but not a very big attack dog.
like a terrier.
Yeah, a terrier. And he threw out, I mean, it seemed like he came prepared with a huge cache of ammunition to throw, and he just was trying to get it in at every moment, and he was interrupting a lot, and it was kind of off-putting. And to contrast that, you had Mike Pence, who's smooth, he's every hair is in place, he's very calm and collected, and he starts off with this speech that's very genial and personal and talking to the camera, and, you know, he looks presidential. He looks like a good choice in terms of somebody that, you know, if something were to happen to the commander-in-chief, we'd feel okay maybe with somebody that looks like that looks and acts that way. But again, when it came to the facts, he kept shaking. You're right. The split screen helped him a lot. He kept shaking his head and denying and sort of smiling and waving off things that Tim Kaine was saying. Later, it came out that a lot of the things he was denying
were true.
Yeah. That actually happened. But this campaign is a different kind of campaign and you know, this season. And we don't know how much voters are actually following up with what is actually true and actually trying to find out whether what he said was right.
Yeah. Michael, not that many people watched this debate. It was, I think, about 37 million.
That's what I've heard.
Do you think it's going to have any impact on the race?
No, I really don't. From that performance, no, I don't think so. What it really sort of solidified is the idea that it's really all about the top of the ticket. And in one sense, it's really just Hillary versus Hillary in some sense. It's almost a referendum. Do you want Hillary Clinton for president or almost anybody else. Because I think Donald Trump in some ways falls into that category. And you talk about the fact-checking and that sort of thing. There's a famous line from an American sitcom where a character says, advising his friend, "It's not a lie if you believe it." And
that could be Donald Trump's motto.
I think there's some of that. I think that there's some of that going on with Mike Pence, that he knows what's been said. Of course he knows what's been said. He's been there. He's seen it. He's read it. But to defend his candidate, the person who he's performing the surrogate role for, you know, during this debate, he has to find a way to not even explain it, just get around it, just go with it. Like many of the Trump voters, I think, people and Clinton voters as well, they're not necessarily concerned with what happened. It's almost as much about keeping the other guy out as getting my guy in.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'll probably leave it there. Of course, our listeners know there's another major presidential debate coming up, and this one will be a town hall format, and the questions will not necessarily come from friendly members of the audience. So it'll be interesting to see. Hillary Clinton has some experience dealing with that sort of situation. It'll be interesting to see how Donald Trump will react to hostile questioning. Yeah.
Yeah, he's shown himself to be rather thin-skinned, but Mike Pence was an example of that maybe Donald Trump can follow of how to let things roll off you, basically. So
we've yet to see that with Donald Trump.
I don't think so.
We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, as far as this, you know, Hillary running against Hillary, I think that this Trump campaign is indicative of something that we're seeing. It's kind of a global phenomena of people being dissatisfied with the establishment leadership.
Status quo.
And that it's not only a matter of Hillary running against Hillary. She's also running against a populace who has a certain amount of enthusiastic support, and that is almost part of a movement around the world. You know, we're seeing it with, you know, in Russia, we're seeing it in with the Brexit vote in Philippines, where they've voted in this Mr. Duterte. And there are other places where these populists are in France gaining more attention than they used to command, and becoming real players on the political scene.
We were talking earlier, Michael, about the danger also of believing the polls. The polls, as we're speaking, show Hillary up, but everything will depend on the turnout. And in Colombia, there was a referendum on their peace agreement, and it narrowly lost. And one of the reasons was because the turnout was very, very low, only 37% or something like that. So I think that's going to be the real determinant in our election, is turnout and whether the people who say they're going to vote for a certain candidate actually come out.
And that's why not only does the electoral map work out well for Hillary, the fact that she has so many boots on the ground in so many states, I mean, that political organization is formidable. And Donald Trump has virtually none of that. So you can't, you know, Twitter doesn't get people. That doesn't pull someone out of their house, get them in a bus, and get them to the polls. No, that's people. That's volunteers. And that organization is second to none, you know, in our political lifetimes, I think. So, but everything counts now in terms of turnout. You've been talking about now the hurricane that's looming in Florida affecting the mail-in ballots, with mail-in ballots being such a big part
of
the Florida vote
now. And voter registration as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wanted to move on and mention that there has been a very important selection for the world, not necessarily for the United States, but we have a new UN Secretary General designate, Oren. This gentleman has a lot of experience when it comes to, I guess, one of the major issues facing the world today, namely the refugee crisis. What can you tell us about our new UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres?
Antonio Guterres is a former Prime Minister of Portugal. He spent 10 years from 2005 to 2015 as the High Commissioner for Refugees at the United Nations. And in that capacity, he dealt with the aftermath of the tsunami in South Asia, you know, so natural disasters, with the war in Gaza in 2014, the war in Ukraine, and especially the war in Syria and somewhat Afghanistan, and the European migrant crisis.
Right.
So
Libya,
all these are in Libya.
North Africa.
Right. So all these very large crises. And his style, he's known to be not at all shy about calling out leaders, world leaders, and telling them what they need to do and what's expected of them and what the moral imperative is. So he has this managerial experience and also this rather assertive style. So people are expecting him to be, you know, at least one of the best people. I mean, he was chosen because supposedly he's the best person for the job, but he actually has the experience to kind of back that up.
Yeah. Michael, there was a little disappointment that a woman wasn't chosen. There were a number of women who ran informally for the position, but not this time. I don't know what that says about the UN or whether it's simply the qualities of Guterres that made the determination.
As Warren mentioned, the resume was sort of right for the times when you talk about his experience with refugees. That's certainly one of the great crises that is facing our world at this time, something that the UN, by mission statement, should be participating in heavily. I think there was some disappointment, certainly, that when you had so many well-qualified women near the top of the ballot, and I think the fourth largest vote getter was a woman. That was the highest placed in the voting.
Still a glass ceiling when
Still
it comes to
There were some people that were also rooting for an Eastern European candidate, which hasn't happened before. I think, you know, one of the real questions is, first, about this particular candidate, Mr. Guterres. There has been some questioning of his handling of the finances of that particular department during he's been up for investigation twice over that term for major sort of mishandling of the funds. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some raised eyebrows about that. But really, the question is, what can this UN do? What can a Security Council head do? What does this organization do about the big problems of the day? The war in Syria, about Aleppo, about terrorism? You know, what can he bring a measure of effectiveness back to that organization? Because right now, I think it's as impotent as I have seen it in global affairs.
Yeah. We are getting low on time, and I wanted to go to another issue that actually may pop up in the UN before President Obama leaves office, and that's the question of Israel-Palestine, Oren. We saw some very unusually harsh words from the State Department in the last few days, quote, strongly condemning the Israelis for some more settlement construction, very, very deep in the West Bank, closer to the border with Jordan than to the border with pre-1967 Israel. This came right after the United States approved a $38 billion military aid package to Israel for the next 10 years. You know, it's Shimon Peres, the last great advocate of peace, has died, and I tweeted, you know, and the two-state solution is dead too. It certainly seems to look like that, doesn't it?
So, first of all, the Israeli response to this strong condemnation from the State Department was that, well, you know, there are 98 new homes, and it's going to be eventually 300 new homes, but they're in a pre-existing settlement. So,
which is already very deep
deep into the West Bank. So the Israelis have not backed off of their settlement policy, despite the fact that, according to the White House, they gave assurances that there would be no more new settlements. And I think the White House felt particularly burned by this because President Obama had just come back from
the funeral
where he gave a eulogy for Shimon Peres. So, you know, there are questions now as to, you know, whether the United States is somehow going to somehow retaliate or press the issue at the UN maybe and join a resolution to, I don't know, condemnation or expression of concern or something.
Or parameters for a two-state solution.
Or like issue that. Parameters for a two-state solution. Obviously, they can do that, but I don't see how any of that is actually going to change matters on the ground.
Yeah.
Because the Israelis don't seem to be in a particular hurry to get there. And the Palestinians also don't seem in a particular hurry to get there. They haven't been willing to sit down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael, the geopolitical situation, even the regional situation, is not putting pressure on Israel to make any concessions, is it?
No, they are not. You know, as you said, that was an embarrassing situation for the president. It's happened before when the vice president was there. Look, this is partially a solution to an internal problem that the Israelis had because they were moving settlers from Palestinian-owned land. So they got them out of there and moved them and did the usual legal trick of saying, well, this is just an extension of an existing settlement. This is a standard card that they play. Look, the two-state solution, I don't think, has any belief by Benjamin Netanyahu. I just don't think he believes in it. He's interested in expanding and controlling as much land as possible until, quote-unquote, Palestinian is a demilitarized state. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, this looks like it's yet another issue that will wind up in the lap of the next U.S. president. Indeed. And that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Orrin Durell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.